Welcome to the latest episode of Schneps Connects. Today I have with me Amanda Berman, who's the founder of Zionists, a coalition of Jewish activists and allies who are unabashedly progressive and unapologetically Zionist. They are a grassroots organization with more than 30 chapters across the country, fighting for the advancement of social, racial, economic, environmental, and gender justice in America. They are also committed to fighting for Zionism and the inclusion of Zionists in social justice spaces because Zionism is itself a progressive value, the movement of liberation and national self-determination of the Jewish people in our indigenous homeland. Zionists is rooted in Jewish values, stands for justice and equality, and fights against all forms of oppression. Amanda works to empower and activate Zionists on the progressive left to stand proudly in social justice spaces as Jews and Zionists. She is also a civil rights attorney who previously worked to fight anti-Semitism legally. Amanda writes and speaks and presents on Jewish and civil rights issues and is a media contributor across various mediums and outlets. So thank you, Amanda. I really appreciate you joining the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you're fighting on behalf of Israel. Obviously, the October 7th massacre has created a lot of turmoil and political divide across the world and in our country here in the United States. So one of the things I was interested in wanting to ask you and hearing, you know, more about you and your organization is to hear how the organization is progressive and Zionist. You don't always really think of those two together. So I would love for you maybe just to share a bit about that and the organization overall.
Sure. So thanks for that question. So our tagline is unabashedly progressive, unapologetically Zionist. And like you said, a lot of people think those two identities can't go together. There's some inherent contradiction or conflict between being progressive and Zionist. But that's a pretty modern thing. That's a pretty recent thing that these things don't go together. As you said in the introduction, Jewish people see Zionism as really the original progressive movement, a movement of liberation for one of the world's most enduring persecuted minority communities. So when we talk about progressive values, freedom, liberation, self-determination, you know, and ability to protect oneself from a world that, you know, constantly shows its apathy at best to Jewish life, Zionism makes a lot of sense. And if you know anything about the history of Zionism, you know that its founder, the founder of the modern political Zionist movement, Theodor Herzl, saw Zionism as just the beginning of the Jewish people's commitment to liberating all marginalized communities. So the fact that in America, our political polarization has led to a situation in which American Jews who overwhelmingly identify with the political left have been at the forefront of social justice activism for every progressive value and movement in the history of this country, that we should have to check a piece of our Jewish identities at the door, our Zionism, which is intrinsic to our Jewish identities, that we should have to leave that behind in our activism to make a better, stronger, more pluralistic, you know, more democratic America. That is where there is a contradiction. That is where, you know, the progressive movement is actually abandoning its own progressive values. So, you know, at Zionists, it's our goal both to reclaim Zionism as what it is, a progressive liberation movement, and, you know, a part of the progressive movement, part of our values as people who believe in social justice and equality and human dignity for all people, and reclaim what it means to be progressive from those who are really, you know, weaponizing the term progressive to exclude Jews and doing so in a way that perverts the meaning of the word progressive. You can't celebrate and champion terrorism, rape, slaughter, burning people alive and call yourself a progressive as some people are doing. And we're really trying to hold a mirror to that.
Yeah. I mean, for me, you know, obviously being Jewish, someone that's had, you know, family that has died in the Holocaust, others that, you know, really escaped Europe and came to the United States to find a safe place, I was certainly, you know, horrified by what happened on October 7th. And I have to say, very shocked, yet not surprised at the rise in anti-Semitism here in the United States and really how open people are in New York, where I live and work, New York City particularly, which is, you know, call it the Jewish capital of the United States based on population. So I can imagine how bad it must be in other places. What are you seeing in terms of, you know, pure anti-Semitism, and what are some of the things your organization is doing to combat it?
So we're both in New York, and as you know, the explosion of anti-Semitism here has been so painful to watch, and for some shocking, but as you said, you know, I think for me, and sounds like for you, not so surprising. If you've been following the trends you know that this version of anti-Semitism that exists in the left is not new, unfortunately. It's covered up. People claim that anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. It's criticism of the Israeli government. That's not what anti-Zionism is. Criticism of the Israeli government is criticism of the Israeli government. I think we know what criticism looks like. It looks like understanding something and challenging it based on the merits, based on the facts, based on an understanding of history and reality. Demonizing people, calling Jews Zionists and demonizing us, marginalizing us, kicking us out of progressive spaces, again, celebrating our slaughter. I'm sure you saw on October 8th, there was a DSA rally, pro-Hamas rally, yes, Times Square, that I actually went to with a board member of ours, Alicia Wiesel, and we went together. You know, he's not new to fighting for the Jewish people. No one in his family is new to fighting for the Jewish people. For he and I to be there waving an Israeli flag and singing Hatikva the day after the largest slaughter of Jews since the gas chambers, and seeing people literally celebrating what had happened on October 7th. Somebody there had a swastika and was waving it very proudly. People were making gestures of sexual assault and violence at those of us who were across the street from the protest. And that was just the beginning. That was the day after. So since then, we've seen, you know, protests marching through the street, people chanting from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. I think many of them don't know what river or what sea, don't know what it is that they're calling for, which is a second genocide of the Jewish people. But so many people are being swept up in this idea that somehow this genocide, this, you know, destruction of the Jewish state, this celebration of October 7th, as though it is justified resistance. You know, there are people who are chanting resistance by any means necessary, seemingly including the rape, slaughter, brutalization, kidnapping, and the dehumanization really of Jews that I think has been going on for quite a while, since long before October 7th. And we see it with, for example, people tearing down the posters of the hostages. And I think, you know, to be able to rip down a poster with the face of a 6-month-old baby and believe that this person is not human, is not worthy of solidarity or support or even empathy, it comes from many years of dehumanization of Jews and the idea that Jews who are indigenous to the land of Israel actually have no right to be there in the first place. This has been going on for a long time. I often trace the origin of this anti-Zionism to 1975. I sound sort of like a conspiracy theorist when I say this, but in 1975, the Soviet Union introduced a resolution at the UN that said Zionism is racism. And it wasn't actually really about Jews. It was Cold War Soviet propaganda that was intended to harm Western influence in the Middle East, Israel, but it really worked to institutionalize anti-Semitism in the global left. And so, you know, that was the beginning of this new old form of anti-Semitism where, you know, Israel is the worst evil of the world. It is committing genocide, apartheid, colonialism. You know, it is the worst thing, you know, that human beings know and the thing that we most have to resist.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very strange thing when, you know, Judaism predates both Christianity and Islam by thousands of years, yet people, you know, don't understand that they were in these lands before others. I think a lot of times when I, you know, think of anti-Semitism, and you mentioned the tearing down of posters. We've reported on it tremendously, and there's been video of it, is how shocking who it is. A lot of young people, a lot of young white people that are tearing down posters. So I think a lot of it, you know, is anti-Semitism for sure, but I guess how much of it is lack of education or historical knowledge, and what do you think can really be done about it?
It's a great question. You know, I often say I think anti-Semitism is the ultimate motivating factor, but so many people just don't understand what it is that they're going along with. And I think the real culprit here is social media, because so many people are seeing other people in their social circles posting, again, these dehumanizing things about Jews, this idea that October 7th was legitimate resistance to oppression and colonization. And, you know, you get social capital by participating in this narrative. And so many people in this era of social media are experiencing, you know, a lot of loneliness and a lot of social isolation. And so they feel like, you know, by taking up this narrative, they're virtue signaling, and that will help them become accepted in various social circles. And that's a thing that is, you know, way beyond my pay grade. I do think social media is so incredibly dangerous in this sense. And it's, you know, dangerous with the mental health of young people anyway. So, of course, anti-Semitism is going to spread more easily there. Though anti-Semitism has been an animating force and really quite a powerful organizing force for thousands of years. What to do about it, obviously, is very challenging. What we do at Zionist is work to build coalitions and partnerships with non-Jewish progressive allies who we can be in relationship with and advance social justice causes with. Again, Jews have been at the forefront of every social justice movement this country has ever known. And the idea that we can't participate is not only wrong, but it's incredibly dangerous. We can look at, for example, the British Labour Party, the Canadian Green Party, movements like the Women's March and Black Lives Matter to see that anti-Semitism, including anti-Zionism, is really a malignant and metastatic force that destroys everything it touches. And so if we want to protect our ability to achieve progress in the progressive movement, we have got to confront the anti-Semitism that exists in these spaces. And when you're in relationship with people, you can have those conversations. When you are properly trained how to engage constructively, instead of going on social media, screaming and yelling, getting into a fight with a stranger in the comment section, actually building the real life relationships in the progressive movement, you can make change. And we see it and we're doing it all the time. It's obviously hard, right? Relational organizing is one-on-one. It takes time, emotional investment, a lot of energy. The payoff takes a while to see, whereas when you're online, you know, the kind of endorphins are flowing immediately. You get, you know, you're in it, you're fighting people. There's an emotional reaction and it's sort of satisfying to yell at someone, but it's not going to move the needle in any way. And, you know, we see that a lot of the online activism that happens generally and certainly in the political space doesn't translate into real life. So a lot of what goes on Twitter really has no actual relationship to our American politics. So we're kind of betting at Zionist and certainly praying that the real life work that we're doing can overcome all the hate that is, you know, just growing every minute on social media.
Well, ironically, the United States and Israel are both democracies, right? For people to know that. And, you know, when it comes to democracies, getting out to vote is critical. How are you engaged in terms of getting people to actively vote and to get involved in supporting elected officials that recognize, you know, the basic right of Israel to exist?
So this is, you know, certainly something that we care about as people. It's not our primary mission at Zionist. There are lots of organizations in the Jewish landscape that are particularly focused on supporting candidates, pro-Israel candidates, people who are, you know, voting, for example, to pass this aid package and get this done ASAP, people who are not calling for a unilateral ceasefire and expecting Israel to leave 134 Israeli citizens, you know, in terror tunnels and torture dungeons without fighting back to get our people. So that's a conversation that we're engaged in all the time. But again, because we're a grassroots activist organization, our work is really about identifying and supporting political leaders in an organizing capacity, doing the justice work together so that we have relationships before people want to run for higher office. And, you know, making sure that in cities where Zionist has a chapter and a presence that, you know, we're building alongside all of our progressive partners and allies and, you know, building really a better, stronger progressive movement that understands that the Jewish community is part of it and that we're never going to abandon our Zionism or our commitment to Israel in that work. But the politics obviously are, I think, going to come to a head in 2024. I think that, you know, the sort of fight, the weaponization of Jewish identity, anti-Semitism and Israel, frankly, in both political parties. And you know, I think overwhelmingly, I know that overwhelmingly American Jews identify with the left. Something like 75% of American Jews are registered Democrats. Jews overwhelmingly vote. Something like 85% of our community is politically engaged. It's much higher than the national average. So I have no doubt that the Jewish community is going to show up at the polls and make sure that they're voting for people who represent our values and our safety.
Yeah, no, it's definitely going to be interesting. As we're speaking today, there's a congressional seat that's up for grabs, that the race, you know, is predicted to be extremely close either way, with, you know, Israel playing a major, you know, part in people's decisions, although both candidates, Democrat and Republican, are supportive of Israel. So I think it's going to be a big movement of votes over the next year with the presidential election coming up as well, for sure. Talk a little bit about, you know, progressives, whether they're elected officials or, you know, heads of progressive organizations. Are you finding that your engagement with them has been, I don't know, call it fruitful?
You know, it just depends. And this is why I say that this one-on-one relationship building work is time consuming. It requires a real investment and patience and, you know, a belief that it's going to pay off in terms of, you know, the constructive and hopeful and fruitful engagement. A lot of times the answer is yes. also a lot of times, even when we are able to engage constructively, there is such a fear of making a public statement because of the backlash that can come on social media that can then actually urge other people to not stand up as allies. So we've seen this over and over again, where people who are not Jewish, who are, you know, part of other marginalized communities, have used their platforms to stand with the Jewish community, and they get targeted so viscerally, both by members of their own community and, frankly, what appear to be bots, right? I mean, there's so much going on social media that we don't even understand exactly what's happening. But the response is so swift and so overwhelming that other people who are watching think to themselves, there is no benefit to me actually using my platform in any way to stand in solidarity with the Jewish community. So, you know, we've gotten a lot of private solidarity, a lot of outreach from people who say, I'm seeing what's going on. I'm standing with you. I'm having lots of conversations in my community. Some of the conversations that we've been having might really surprise you. Some of them have just been extraordinary people who have, you know, frankly, perpetuated anti-Semitism in really dangerous ways, are meeting now with Zionist members and activists and members of our Zahav Fellowship. We have a fellowship for Black Jewish Zionists who've been doing extraordinary work, having conversations in their communities. And, you know, what I think is happening is that people woke up to October 7th. Obviously, there are a lot of people who are denying October 7th, and, you know, there's no reason, in my view, to engage with people like that. But there are a lot of people who woke up on October 7th and saw those images and videos and started to see the response from within their own organizing spaces, and they were mind blown. And they simply couldn't square what they were seeing with what they were hearing from people that they considered allies and, you know, activists, friends who are in activist spaces with them. And so they started reaching out and, you know, trying to figure out who they could talk to that could explain what's actually going on here and why this decolonial narrative, this binary oppressor versus oppressed, Jews are white privileged colonizers, Palestinians are, you know, brown victims, why things are just not so straightforward and simple. And it's, you know, it's not to deny the Palestinian experience, and it's certainly not to deny the Israeli experience, but to say there is a conflict here that doesn't fit, you know, as you said, Jews don't fit into any of these categories that, you know, we talk about today when we talk about race and, you know, and the sort of boxes that we sort of put people in terms of identity. Understanding that Israel, Jewish identity, Zionism is a 2,000-year-old movement, the Jewish people, a 4,000-year-old people. We far predate any of these different boxes, and helping people understand that this isn't a simple oppressor versus oppressed binary. And if it were, the Jewish people, again, 2% of the population of this country, 0.2% of the population of the world, 15 million of us left on planet Earth right now. Somebody kidnaps 240 Jews. That is a major, major threat to Jewish life everywhere. People are just kind of realizing that.
Yeah, I mean, as you bring up those statistics, and, you know, to me, one of the most amazing things is how Jews are not recognized as a minority or even under that umbrella of DEI, you know, and I'm not exactly sure why that is. Maybe because, you know, there are people that are prominent in different, you know, public facing industries that are Jewish. So because they're in leadership positions in some cases, what is your take on that?
It's a great question. So I often refer to the sort of genesis moment of Zionist when I get this question. So we were at an event called the Chicago Slut Walk, which is definitely a radical event. But the Slut Walk was launched after a rape trial in Toronto where a woman was put on the stand and asked, you know, why were you in that place at that time? Were you drinking? Why were you wearing, you know, what were you wearing? So classic victim blame. You know, this is very typical.
I never heard of that.
So this happens all the time in rape trials. The accused was acquitted, and it became an international movement about rape culture and patriarchy and victim blaming, blaming a woman for having been victimized because she was wearing, you know, slutty clothes. Basically, that's why it's called the Slut Walk. The Slut Walk had banned Jewish stars as Zionist symbols of racism and oppression before the event. And this is part of a history I could go on for hours about all of these different progressive movements that had done similar things, kicked out Jewish women, Jewish activists, you know, the Women's March saying you can't be a Zionist and a feminist. So this was, you know, part of a year-long kind of attack on Jewish life and Zionism in progressive spaces from 2016 to 2017. So a year of extreme political polarization in America in general, and the Jewish community really being squeezed and not feeling like we had anywhere to fit in. So the date of the Slut Walk was August 12th, 2017. August 12th, 2017 was also the date of the neo-Nazis marching in Charlottesville, Virginia. When I was at the Slut Walk and Zionist was launched that day, the language that I was hearing at the Slut Walk was almost identical to the language that the neo-Nazis were chanting in Charlottesville. The far left and the far right meet in their demonization of Jews. In the left, it's the Zionists. Go back to Europe, right? You don't belong here. You're white colonizers. In the right, it's go back to Palestine, go back to Israel. We don't care where you come. We don't care where you go back to, but you're not welcome here. And I talk about the fact that anti-Semitism operates really the same way, no matter what the political ideology is. It might have a slightly different frame, but at the end of the day, the Jews are the marionette, the people who are pulling the strings, who are creating a society that is different from the society that these people want. So in the right, the Charlottesville neo-Nazis, they were chanting, "Jews will not replace us." People sometimes think they're worried that Jews are going to procreate at such a rate that we're going to overtake white Christian patriarchy. Obviously, we know we're 2% of the population. That's not happening. What that means, Jews will not replace us, is that Jews are seen for good reason as allies to marginalized communities and have worked to uplift Black and brown people, immigrants and refugees, LGBTQ people, women. So the people who are seen who are threats to white Christian patriarchy. The idea in white supremacist spaces is that Jews are the ones who are pulling the strings, because all of these communities could never advance on their own without some ephemeral force that's working to help advance them. And so the Jews are responsible for creating the society that the white supremacist does not want to see. When you look at the left, it's the same thing. The Jews are the ones who are pulling the strings, who are creating the society that the left doesn't want to see. The left wants a society that advances communities of color, marginalized people, immigrants and refugees, LGBTQ and women. Who are the ultimate oppressors? The white people. Who are the ultimate white people? The Jews. So in both cases, the Jews are the ones who are, again, creating the society that people don't want to see. We are always the ones who hold the supernatural power, who are controlling and dominating the world to our own interest and to our own benefit. And so, again, at the end of the day, it's all the same thing. But this idea in the left that the Jews are the ultimate white oppressors, when you export that idea onto Israel, you determine that Israel is this colonizing, you know, genocidal terror state. It has no relationship whatsoever to the facts on the ground in the Middle East. But that is the idea. That is, and it is an age-old anti-Semitic trope. It's not a new idea. It's not even creative or interesting. But we've been fighting this for a long time to great consequence.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you look at it from the right, you look at it from the left, it's anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
You know, if you could imagine them calling out another group that wouldn't be allowed at that parade, people would go wild.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely wild. So, yeah, I think at the end of the day, it's pretty clear that in a lot of these cases, it's just pure and simple hatred.
Totally. That's, you know, if there's, I mean, October 7th, again, biggest catastrophe in Jewish life in almost 80 years. If there is some tiny, small silver lining, it's how many Jews woke up to the fact that this anti-Semitism in the left is real. How many people realize that instead of pointing at some other political space, wherever you sit ideologically, there is anti-Semitism in your space, and it is on you to fight it? Because if you're pointing over there and saying all the anti-Semitism is over there, you know, and you are going tribal and protecting your political space and from criticism and, you know, from identifying that there's a problem in it, you're not fighting anti-Semitism. You're weaponizing it for partisan political gain. I think a lot of people who identify with the left woke up and were like, oh my God, I never thought it could get this bad in the left. I thought we were the justice-oriented people. I thought we were the human rights people. I never thought we would demonize people for who they are or how they were born. That's a thing that people have woken up to. And I think the way that we've responded, the sort of passion and commitment and connection, the Jewish community feels so connected right now in responding to this threat in a way that can be constructive and effective, both, again, for protecting our people, but also for protecting democracy, because anti-Semitism destroys everything it touches, and it's been known to destroy entire societies before.
Yeah, I definitely think it was a wake-up call, because, you know, like, I have called grandparents that would tell me about the Holocaust and about anti-Semitism. And growing up, I don't think I really thought about anti-Semitism much.
Right.
October 7th was kind of like, you know, getting hit over the head, realizing, yes, it is here. Yes, it's not something that went away, although your generations before you had really been like chased after, if not murdered over it. And, you know, I think a big part of Judaism that a lot of people don't understand is that a lot of people feel it not just as a religion, but as a culture. And, you know, a lot of people perceive Jews in a lot of ways when they see Orthodox, versus understanding that this is my culture, in many cases, more than even religion. I guess, what are some of the things that you can recommend to other people that can be supportive of Zionism and or just like Jewish friends and or their own selves that aren't civically or politically active? What recommendation would you give to people to be supportive?
That's a really great question. I would recommend that people actually look up what Zionism is, because I think so many people have the wrong idea. There's been such a demonization of Zionists for so long. You know, I think people think that this is a really recent thing. And I often refer back to 1903, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. That was really, you know, the inspiration for Hitler's Mein Kampf, which ultimately, you know, turned into the plan for the extermination of Jews during the Holocaust. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion demonized the Jews as the Elders of Zion and claimed that we were this, you know, trying to dominate the world through our control of the banks, the media, and the political sphere. These are, again, the tropes that we've seen over and over again throughout history and we see right now as well. And we were called the Zionists. So it's not about Israel. Anti-Zionism is not about Israel. There was no Israel in 1903. Israel was reestablished as a Jewish state in 1948. So this was 45 years before Israel was even reestablished. And so when people say anti-Zionism is about Israel or it's about Israel's, you know, occupation of the West Bank or you know, oppression of Palestinians, you can have a conversation about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, about the geopolitics of the Middle East, without denying the Jewish right to self-determination in our native homeland. People don't realize that because such a binary has been set up. Are you with the Jews and the Israelis, or are you with the Palestinians? And that's not going to liberate anyone. That idea that you have to choose one is only going to lead to more war and more perpetuation of the conflict. So even the most basic education, and we have lots of resources on our website. We have a resources tab of our website. We run lots of fellowships and trainings and, you know, really basics that we offer lots of, you know, basic understanding. Our social media also does the same thing. And even beyond understanding Zionism and understanding it as a liberation movement, to your really important point, understanding what a Jew is, because we are actually not a religious group. We are a nation. And so understanding that the Jewish people have shared ethnic backgrounds, that when you do a DNA test, it will come up. I don't actually want to make an assumption about you. It will come up for me that I'm Ashkenazi Jew. I'm going to make that assumption about you, but you might be Sephardic or Mizrahi. But we would come up Jewish in our DNA. Now, you can convert and be a Jew and be just as much of a Jew, you know, without having Jewish DNA, but we are a people and a nation. And so as a nation, we are entitled to national sovereignty, just as we argue as progressives that all other nations should be entitled to national sovereignty in this modern, you know, world of nation states. So when you understand that the Jewish people, just going back to a point you made at the beginning, that we don't fit into these boxes, you know, we're not a racial group, although we've been racialized in ways that have been harmful. We're not a religious group, although we've been targeted as a religious group in ways that have been harmful. You know, the idea that the Jews killed Jesus and that that was a religious, you know, mandate, and that all Jews, you know, collectively and in perpetuity should be held responsible and frankly killed for the death of Jesus, you know, the original blood libel. So we've been pushed into boxes in ways that justifies targeting us violently, but we don't, as our self-definition and as our lived experience, we don't actually fit into any of those boxes. Talking to a Jewish person can help answer a lot of those questions. I know a lot of people don't know a Jewish person because, again, we're only 2% of the population of America, but doing even just the most basic research and just trying to hold a little bit of humanity for us right now when we are experiencing this really viscerally painful moment can go a long way.
Yeah, listen, that's great advice. I mean, I think, you know, even the basic advice, if you're Jewish, don't be afraid to talk about it.
Yeah.
Because I know a lot of people in my family and friends that are nervous, you know, taking off necklaces or taking down mezuzahs or doing other things that they don't want people to know they're Jewish because they're worried about it, right? They're concerned. So I think on the flip side of that, it's like, no, you have to, like, you know, wear it on your outside sleeve and let people understand more about our culture. Look at you.
Yeah, you can see me
all outfitted. This is
wearing a Zionist sweatshirt. I've got an Israel necklace, a chai, a Jewish star. And people commented and think crazy. And it's really true. Now, I don't want to shame anybody who feels scared. There is a really good reason to feel scared right now with a 400% explosion of anti-Semitic incidents in this country. But in my experience, people don't mess with you when you are confident. They're bullying you when they seem like that, when they feel like they can make you ashamed of who you are. Again, I do not want to shame anyone who is afraid. I will say one of the most meaningful moments of allyship for me over the past few months was a Black non-Jewish friend, an incredible Black leader, someone who's in the media, called me a couple of weeks after October 7th and she said, I want you to come over and put a mezuzah on my door. And I was like, literally, Jews are taking mezuzot off of their doors. Are you sure? This is dangerous. Like, I don't want anyone to attack you. And she said, if they're coming for you, they're coming for me. Come over and put this mezuzah on my door. Now, again, I don't expect anything like that from anyone. It was the most extraordinary feeling of solidarity that she wanted that. And she felt like, you know, it was her responsibility as an ally to the Jewish people to signal it, you know, in a way that felt very personal to her. So there are a lot of ways, again, I don't expect anyone to do anything like that, but even just the most simple, benign thinking of you goes so far. And for my Jews, you know, being able to say, I'm a Zionist, I'm a proud Zionist, I care about liberation for everyone, I care deeply about Palestinians. You know, there's nothing wrong with saying that you are pained by the images out of Gaza. It's horrifying. Yeah. Wish for this. Of course not. We want Hamas to surrender and release the hostages so that the war can end and nobody else has to suffer. But, you know, the idea that Israel is going to leave its people, again, given how tiny our population is, it's just, it's never going to happen.
Yeah, I think two other things that I think are like important points for people to know and I think should be communicated more is, one is that there's a lot of non-white Jews.
Yes.
You know, whether they're, you know, from the Middle East or from Ethiopia. You know, one of the things I remember, you know, distinctly in each of the times that I visited Israel was the amount of, you know, Black Jews in the IDF.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, Jews are from all over the world. And I think it really leads to my second point, which is that the Jews have been chased out of almost every country in Europe and the Middle East and even Africa to the point that they had to find a sanctuary of safety, which created Israel, and that people who fight for the destruction of Israel, myself, I feel, and I think most Jewish people do, it's basically calling for the extinction of Jews as a whole.
I could not agree more. I do think a lot of people who call for the destruction of Israel don't know that's what they're calling for. But I, of course, agree it would be the consequence if, God forbid, what they wanted came to be. And you're also touching on so many really important points. When people export this, you know, racial idea, this racial lens of Jews as white people onto Israel, they are completely denying the lived experience of the majority of Jews in Israel who are refugees from the Middle East and North Africa, who were kicked out in the last century with literally nothing. Black and brown Jews who lived for centuries, you know, in the Middle East and North Africa. And you know, 20% of Israeli society is also Arab. Arab and Bedouin Israelis were victims on October 7th as well. So this is a diverse country, a very diverse country. And even in America, 15 to 20% of American Jews identify as Jews of color. As I mentioned, we have this fellowship called Zahav at Zionist, this Black Jewish Zionist fellowship. These amazing people who are really trying to respond to this idea that Jews are white and, you know, and that Israel is a white colonizer state. And it shocks people sometimes when they realize that actually the Jewish people are so diverse. And this is actually the story of Zionism, that the Jewish people born at Mount Zion, mountain in Jerusalem, were expelled by the Romans 2,000 years ago from Israel and were scattered to every corner of the earth. For 2,000 years, we all prayed in the direction of Zion. Jews who were not connected didn't know that other Jews existed, right? They weren't connected by Twitter. They couldn't tweet at each other. They didn't have phones. They didn't have, you know, planes, trains, or automobiles. They were all doing the same customs. They were praying in the direction of Jerusalem. They were saying next year in Jerusalem on all of their holy occasions. They were saying Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, three times a day if they were observant. Israel was so core to Jewish identity, Jewish faith, Jewish peoplehood. You know, it is so like intrinsic to Jewish identity, Zion and Zionism and Israel. People don't understand that. So Jews all over the world came back to Israel in 1948. It's a veritable progressive miracle and just miracle in general. But it's, you know, we talk about Zionism as the ingathering of the exiles. It's not a bunch of people from Europe. It's people from all over the world who were never safe in any other society who finally had a chance to go back to their native homeland and build a society that could protect them from, you know, all of these attempts at Jewish extermination. And Israel's not going to let it happen again.
Well, from your mouth to God's ears, Amanda, thank you so much for, you know, your time and for the work that you're doing and sharing your story. I really appreciate you being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been so fun to chat with you.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks for joining the Schneps Connects podcast. You can visit our website at podcast.schnepsmedia.com or stream us on all major podcast networks.